You're listening to Bottom Shelf Bitcoin. This is episode 1. Relax. Enjoy your coffee. Okay. Hey, buddy. Good morning, everyone. Take a chill pill. What is it? Okay. Welcome to Bottom Shelf Bitcoin, the podcast that puts Bitcoin knowledge within everyone's reach. I'm your host, Josh Humphrey. Thanks for tuning in. All right, welcome to 2018. 2017 was kind of a chaotic year politically, but it was awesome for Bitcoin. Of course, if you're listening to this show, you're probably here because you heard about Bitcoin on the news or online. You're still not really sure what it is. Maybe it's a bubble. Should you be buying? That's kind of what we're going to talk about. Shorter answer is, it's not a bubble. You didn't miss the boat. Yes, you should probably buy, and actually now's probably a really good time. There's lots of podcasts, lots of YouTube channels out there that have really good information. I personally highly recommend Bitcoin and Markets from Ansel Linder. That's a podcast. I also recommend following Andreas Antonopoulos on YouTube. There's a bunch more, but the truth of it is that in the Bitcoin world, things move really fast, and it can be confusing to jump in on the middle of a show that keeps up with current events, current news, what's gone on in the last week. If you don't know what's gone on in the last 5 years or the last 9 years, and that's okay if you're just now getting in. That's kind of the stuff we're going to go over, the basics, right? It's called Bottom Shelf Bitcoin. What do you put on the bottom shelf? Stuff you want everyone to have access to. Stuff you want your kids even to have access to. And I'm not trying to say that in a condescending way. I'm just saying you're new to this, and that's great. We're glad you're here. We're going to go over the basics of what Bitcoin is, how it works on the blockchain, what is a blockchain, how and where do you buy Bitcoin, how do you store your Bitcoin safely? What are altcoins? History of the design? Some of the drama and politics that kind of go on behind the scenes? All that kind of stuff. There's a lot to learn, but the fact that you're here is a great start. And as far as the drama and politics, again, we're not going to keep up with what's going on this week. There's a lot of other good shows. I'm not going to say that I'm on par with those guys. I kind of consider myself an in-betweener. I can kind of understand what they're talking about and distill it down to what information do you need as someone who's just starting out. There's so much there if you really want to get into it, but for most people, it's not necessary to get into all the technical details of all of it. So I'm kind of taking, what do you need to know to start out? All right, so that was a really long intro. Let's get into the heart of this episode. This episode is, what is Bitcoin and why should you care? Bitcoin, listen very carefully, Bitcoin is magic internet money. No, that's a lie. What is it really? It's peer-to-peer electronic cash. And each of those attributes is important. Peer-to-peer, electronic, and cash. And we're going to go over each of those and why they're important. First, though, let's talk about it being electronic. We're going to go out of order here. And when we say electronic, all we mean is it's digital. And you've probably heard Bitcoin's not real. It's just ones and zeros. It's data out there in the ether or whatever. It's in computer la-la land, but it's not real. And that's kind of partly true in that it has no physical, tangible form. And that really is important. And the most immediately important reason why you need to know that is that you don't want to get scammed. In December, there was a man arrested in New York for selling people, quote unquote, bitcoins. The man made $1 million selling people Chuck E. Cheese tokens. And it is funny, but really, truly, it's fraud. And he's selling people something that's different from what he promised. So it is wrong what he did, but it is kind of funny. I mean, Charles E. Cheddar's face is on the coin. It's not a Bitcoin. And this kind of goes with this idea you'll see a lot in the Bitcoin world. You'll see people type DYOR, do your own research. And there's a number of reasons for that. There's no guarantees in Bitcoin. Nobody's guaranteeing your financial success in the future. Nobody wants to be liable, myself included, for your financial success in the future. And you shouldn't be paying for something you don't understand. And clearly, if someone is paying a lot of money for a coin with a mouse on it, they didn't understand what they were even trying to buy. So, with that out of the way, and that truly is, I mean, it's funny, but it truly is important so that you don't get scammed. But moving on and staying within digital, this idea of there's nothing physical there, I think it really scares people. It really unnerves some people. They can't quite process it in their mind. How do you have this thing? I'm going to link in the show notes to an article. I can't remember the author right now. It's on Medium. But the title of the article is, "You Don't Understand Bitcoin Because You Think Money Is Real." And we're going to talk about that some more. But I want you to think about something, and I'm hoping this will kind of put your mind at ease. How much of your daily financial transactions are actually done in cash right now? I want you to think about all the transactions that you make on a daily basis. And then I want you to think about all the transactions, financial transactions that you make in a week, in a month, in a year. How much of that is really cash? And not just how many of those transactions are cash, but think about all the money that you spend in a full year and what percentage of that money is actually spent in cash. Because realistically, most of the things we pay for, especially the big dollar things, are spent with a debit card, a credit card, an ACH payment. Who pays their mortgage in cash? Not a lot of people pay their water bills or their electrical bills or their internet bills in cash. I mean, yeah, if you've got some local municipal thing that you can drive across town and pay someone in cash, okay. But especially like your mortgage or something along those lines, something where you're having to send money off, you're not putting a wad of bills in an envelope and sticking that in the mail. So think about it this way. Whatever job you do, do your customers pay you in cash? And some people really do. Their customers pay them in cash, or a certain amount of their customers pay them in cash. But most people at their job, their customers pay their company with a debit card, a credit card, a gift card, a check, an ACH payment. And that money gets pulled digitally out of that customer's account, and it goes to your company's account. And then when your company pays you, either by check or by direct deposit, that money gets pulled digitally from your company's account into your account. And then when you go and spend money at another store, the money most likely is done by a card or a check, and it moves digitally from your account to that other store's account. Nowhere in all of that did it get converted into physical money. It's not physical cash. The fact that we use the phrase, "I went and pulled cash," should tell you something. It is not the norm to have cash all the time. Now, again, there are exceptions. There are some people who deal primarily in cash. And that's okay. There's nothing wrong with that. Cash has its value. We'll talk about that in a little bit. I'm just saying that's not for most people. Most people do the majority of their financial transactions already in digital. So let that kind of put you at ease. I'll link to the statistics in the show notes, but it's estimated that if you include all the world currencies, only about 8% of all the world currency is in physical paper or metal money. For the US specifically, I think that number is closer to somewhere between 25 and 30%. Those numbers can fluctuate on a month-to-month, year-to-year basis, but that's kind of where it's at, is depending on inflation, is somewhere between 25 and 30% of the U.S. is in physical money. which means somewhere around 70% of U.S. money is actually just digital. Something to think about. So why do we do this? Why? I've gone on this kind of tangent about how you already do everything digitally, but why do we do it digitally? Well, number one, and the biggest reason, is convenience. We were doing this kind of already even before the internet, but especially with the internet, with online shopping and paying your bills, even the bills in town, online, it's just convenient. I can do it from my house. I don't have to leave my house. But even when I do leave my house and I go to a store, it's so much easier for me to carry a wallet that's got 3 cards in it, or 5 cards even, than a whole wad of cash. I don't have to go to the counter and pull out a wad of cash and then sit there and go, okay, which bills do I need to do? Now, I'm not saying you shouldn't know how to make change. You should know how to make change. This is basic math concepts. Okay, if you have to pull out a calculator in order to make change for something, that's a problem. Okay, but what I'm saying is, it is still, even if you know how to make change, way more convenient to just swipe a card. And there's a certain level of safety, security in carrying cards instead of carrying cash. If I go to the gas station and buy a Dr. Pepper and some combos, and I've got $50 in cash in my wallet, and I pull that out and I pay in cash, the guy in line behind me probably saw all that cash. And now I've got to think about, okay, is he going to follow me out to my car in the parking lot and pull a knife on me and take my cash? I don't have to worry about that with cards. Because even, he's probably not going to pull a knife on me for my credit card. But even if he did, he's got a very limited time window in which to spend that money, because I'm going to call the credit card company or the bank that holds that debit card and report it as stolen. And there's protections in place. They're going to cut off the card so he can't spend anymore, and they're not going to make me actually pay for those things that they bought on my name. But this brings us to the downside of electronic payments, of digital payments, and that is there is a record. And that can be good in certain circumstances to have a record, but it may also be something you don't want. Every purchase that you make electronically leaves a trail. It leaves a trail of that transaction tied to you. So what was purchased, for how much, where it was usually, and that's tied to your name. And again, it doesn't mean you're buying bad things, and I'm not saying that someone's actively monitoring every transaction you make, but the record has been created. And all it takes is the wrong person accusing you of something, and now the police or the government is pulling up that record and looking at everything you've ever purchased. Or somebody hacks the bank or hacks the credit card company. And at this point, pretty much all of them have been hacked, or major stores. Look at Target. And now they've got this record of everywhere that you shop. I read an account online. I'll try and track down the source. I think it was somewhere on Reddit, but it was a guy talking about how his identity had been stolen, and it took him a long time to figure out what was going on, because the person that stole it realized that this person frequented a certain shop or restaurant or something, and so they went there, and they made these low-level transactions for like 6 months before he caught on, because it didn't flag on his account. If your record is there, whoever, especially you look at something like Amazon, if you buy stuff from Amazon frequently, the person can then start buying stuff from Amazon with that card. And you're probably not going to notice it very often. Okay, we're going to talk about this more, but there's this idea of privacy and secrecy, and people think, I'm not doing anything wrong. Why do I care if someone looks at what I did? And I just want to challenge you to kind of turn that on its head. Secrecy is more, here's a thing that I don't want anyone to ever know about. Privacy means that I'm controlling who has access to this information. Think about it this way. When you go to the bathroom in public, do you leave the bathroom door and the stall door open? Probably not. Please don't. When you take a shower, do you get the garden hose out and scrub yourself down naked in your front yard? Probably not. Please don't. It doesn't mean that going to the bathroom or taking a shower are wrong or bad. You didn't do anything wrong. Please take showers. But that's not your neighbor's or everyone driving down the street's business. That's the difference. There's some things that aren't wrong, they're just not everybody's business or anybody's business unless you choose to share that with them. In the same way, it shouldn't really be anyone's business what you're buying. And this kind of brings us to cash and the benefits of cash. Now, cash, and I'm speaking specifically of US dollars because maybe there's a case that I'm not thinking of in some foreign currency, but in US dollars, cash is what we call fungible, meaning every dollar is just as equal to every other dollar. Every $1 bill is equal to every other $1 bill, every $5 bill equal to every other $5 bill, right? I think technically they're serialized. This shows you how little I use cash. But no store is checking the number on every single dollar bill. That would take forever. It's ridiculous. So there's no need for them to do that because they accept it as cash. We accept this paper money as the value of what it says on there. There was a time in the U.S. when it was backed by gold. It's not anymore since Nixon took us off the gold standard. But we continue using these paper bills because momentum, right? We used to believe they were worth this, and it's easier if we just continue saying that they're worth this, even though technically they don't actually have any value. Again, go read that article called You Don't Understand Bitcoin Because You Think Money Is Real, or whatever it's called. I'll link to it in the show notes. There's another really good, of all places, How It Works, How Stuff Works, and I'll link to that as well. Kind of similar, the history of money and how we get to where we're at now, and starting out with barter or direct trade of goods, progressing up to where we're at now. And that's a really good read too on the economic side of this. But getting back to this fungibility, right? This track record. Let's go back to the gas station example. If I go to that gas station and I buy my Dr. Pepper and combos and I pay in cash, yes, I've put myself at a certain risk physically from the guy behind me, but I don't leave a trail. There is a transaction record for that gas station because they've got to keep an inventory, but it just says Dr. Pepper combos bought for $7.35 because gas stations charge a lot of money for stuff, and it was paid in cash, and that's it. It doesn't have my name anywhere on there. It may even, it probably even has the time and the date and the physical location, but none of that is connected to me. There's a separation because I used cash. And you'll see this idea put out. Bitcoin is used for drugs, to buy drugs on the internet, on the dark web. Yes, technically that is true. And in the beginnings, the first place that it was accepted, the biggest places that it was accepted were for things like that. But that's not any different from cash today. Just because drug dealers and kidnappers and terrorists use cash doesn't mean it's wrong for your grandma to use cash. My grandma's used cash. It's just something that some people do. They, like we said, there are exceptions and there are people who deal in cash. And so if you write off Bitcoin because, drug dealers and bad people use it, then you have to write off all cash. And to some extent, the government is kind of trying to crack down on cash. Like we said, only 30% of U.S. money exists in cash anyways. And truthfully, a lot of this is because they like that ability to have that record in the event that they want to go snooping. And you draw your own conclusions on whether they're actively watching that or not. I'm not here to say one way or the other. But if they want to, they have the ability to go track that stuff down, track everywhere that you've been if you're not using cash. And so that's why they like doing most of their business in digital money. And the other side of that is it makes inflation so much easier for them to do behind the secrecy of the Fed in computers. They just change the ones and zeros. They loan it out to the banks. The banks turn around and loan it out tenfold to small business owners and homeowners and whatever. They don't have to physically print dollar bills anymore to cause inflation. And so that kind of brings us into the final piece, the peer-to-peer. Another way to say that would be global or international. So when you pay someone in a digital form, there is necessarily a third party. There is someone guaranteeing that transaction, usually a bank or a credit card company, and sometimes there's multiple of those involved in between you and the person you're trying to pay. They exist as guarantors of the money, guarantors of this transaction, right? When you go to a store, they don't trust you. They don't care whether they trust you or not because they trust Wells Fargo or Bank of America or Visa or MasterCard or whoever's on that little card that you're swiping. It's their reputation that is trusted, and so they don't really care who you are. And so when you go to your local farmer's market, maybe, and you pay cash to the lettuce guy, who are they trusting? Because they don't know you. I mean, maybe you go to the farmer's market a lot and now they know you. But the first time you went, they didn't know you. So why do they accept that money if they don't know you? They have no trusting relationship with you and you're not handing them something that they can eat or keep their house warm or cool with. Well, technically, you're still trusting a third party. The third party you're trusting is the government in other countries, whatever country created that money, right? And there's still a third party involved. So banks, credit card companies, they charge you on transaction fees for digital transactions. Usually that fee gets put to the storefront or seller. But basically, you're including a third party. Somebody's got to get their cut. And you're adding another person into this transaction that isn't providing the money and they're not providing the good. So why are they there? And really, it's just reputation. And a lot of what we're trying to do, I didn't create the thing. A lot of what Bitcoin is trying to do is create digital transactions in a trustless way that doesn't require trust. And we'll talk more in the next episode about actually how that's done a little more technically. But that's the goal, right? We don't actually have to trust this person. We don't have to know them in the same way that cash is done. But the difference being, we also don't have to trust any government. Because I could go on and on about inflation in the U.S. It's somewhere around 3% annually average over the last 100 years. Which means that if you're sticking your money in a savings account, you're probably breaking even at best. You know, you might actually be losing money in a savings account because the interest does not keep up with inflation. But let's look at somewhere that's even more so. Let's look at Venezuela right now, or historically look at the Weimar Republic, where people are paying for stuff with wheelbarrows full of cash. Look at Zimbabwe. Hyperinflation leads to the devaluing of the currency. These bills I'm holding in my hand are basically hardly worth anything, so I have to have a much higher volume of them to pay for stuff, and it just gets ridiculous. And so this is where the peer-to-peer, the global, whatever side of it you want to call it, whatever word you want to use there, comes into play. Bitcoin allows you to transact directly with the other person, without having a middleman, without having a bank, without having a credit card company, without having a government in there as a guarantor. You are your own guarantor. And again, we'll go into how this works later, but because of the way it's set up, there's no need to trust that other person because the math, the software side of it fits that need. And because of that, the value of Bitcoin can't be controlled. It can't be pushed up or down by a government. It can't be pushed up or down by a company. It's not controlled by any company, any organization, any person, any government. That's not to say there's not volatility. There is volatility in the price of Bitcoin. You can watch it. But the volatility and the changing price is affected by the market, supply and demand. What are people willing to pay for it? It's not unelected government agents deciding how much they want to raise or lower inflation. Okay, so let's bring it all back. Let's sum it up here. Bitcoin is peer-to-peer electronic cash. In other words, it's got the convenience and safety and speed of being digital. It's got the fungibility, and we're going to say it's pseudo-anonymous. It's not fully anonymous, but it's pseudo-anonymous of cash, and it's not tethered to or regulated by any nation, any bank, any company, any government, any person. So why would you want this? Well, there's a bunch of different reasons. We kind of touched on what's going on in Venezuela right now. There are people who are doing various things. We'll talk about mining in a future episode, but there are people who are mining Bitcoin and these other cryptocurrencies, other altcoins, that are worth far more than their national currency. And they can turn that in, trade it for services, trade it for goods, trade it for whatever currency they need to, and be able to actually afford to feed their families. I really challenge everybody, if you don't know what's going on in Venezuela and how their socialist government has just made everything a wreck for their people, look it up. But maybe you don't live in a country that's doing that, right? Say you live in the U.S. like I do. Yes, there's inflation, and yes, it's wrong the way they do it, but okay, it's not putting you on the street, right? It affects you, but it doesn't affect whether you can eat or not. So you think, okay, but I'd like to put money away and save for the future. I'd like to save for my retirement. I'd like to save for my kid to go to college, whatever. Well, again, with inflation, with capital gains taxes, with things like this, you're discouraging long-term holding. If you think that because of inflation, the value of your dollar today, what you hold in your hand today, if you were to hold on to it for 5 or 10 years, would be worth 70%, 80% of what it's worth today, you're going to want to spend it now on things that will hold their value longer. That's why people buy gold and silver. It's a lot of why people are buying into Bitcoin and then not spending that Bitcoin on anything. They're holding on to it as a hedge against inflation. And I think that's probably right now the strongest argument for buying Bitcoin. Again, there are people who use Bitcoin to buy things that are viewed as nefarious. That's always going to happen with any form of pseudo-anonymity. Or maybe you just believe that eventually Bitcoin's going to take over and Bitcoin is going to be the world currency. These are all good reasons. There's other reasons out there too. There's other use cases. And as we go on with this podcast, I'll try and highlight other use cases as they show up. So take your pick from those or look up other reasons. But yes, Bitcoin is good. It's here. It's not going away. And it's the future. Wait, hold on a second though. How does this work? I mean, if it's a digital file, we've already talked about how the government just makes up their own ones and zeros to inflate the economy. What stops somebody from copying and pasting a million bitcoins into their account? And what stops that from inflating Bitcoin just like every other national currency? Well, it's a technology called the blockchain, and that's what we're going to talk about on our next episode. So stay tuned, come back, listen to the next episode, and we're going to keep going. All right, hopefully this has been informative and helpful, at least to start understanding. I promise you already know a lot more than a lot of people on the street know about Bitcoin. We've still got a ways to go. There's a lot of information to learn. But like I said, you know them more than a lot of people. If you found this information helpful, if you appreciate what I'm trying to do here, share this podcast with your friends and your family, and subscribe so you don't miss a single episode. Also, you can follow me on Twitter at BottomShelfBTC, where I post helpful links and resources and kind of interact with people and kind of will hopefully point you to some other helpful people to follow and news sources, etc., etc. For Bottom Shelf Bitcoin, I'm Josh Humphrey. Thanks for listening. Oh, P.S., one more thing. We'll talk about this more at some point, I'm sure. But since it's digital, Bitcoin can be divided. Actually, it can be divided up to 8 decimal places, with the smallest denomination being called a Satoshi, after the original creator of Bitcoin, Satoshi Nakamoto. All this means, when you see the recent price changes and how it keeps going up and say, how can anyone afford that? Know that you can buy less than one Bitcoin at a time. Alright, see you next time.